Hello, my name is Jonah Gregory. I'm the editor-in-chief of WingDamage.com. I'm also a contributor at SideQuesting.com. I had the privilege of interviewing two of my personal favorite game creators, Mark Crow and Scott Murphy. They're better known as the two guys from Andromeda. Now, these are the guys that made the Space Quest series of adventure games in the late 80s and early 90s. The guys have gotten back together again to bring us a brand new space venture. They have a Kickstarter campaign going to help fund the project, and here they are to talk about the past, present, and future of their working relationship, their time at Sierra, and the current work in progress. I hope you enjoy it.
Show and we're along for the ride.
Jonah Show.
Yeah, I hijacked sidequesting.com where Dally was kind enough to get in touch with I don't know, what do you guys consider him, your PR social media guy, Chris?
He's definitely our PR and social media expert guy. He's also a good businessman too, as he handles many really good voice talent in the voiceover industry for games and for cartoons, and so on. He's got a really interesting resume and quite a clientele. Even Mark and I don't know all of them because some of them involve secrecy agreements and so on. But the ones we do know about are, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that was actually one of my questions once we get into it a little bit.
Okay.
Me today, don't worry about tangents. Those are always good for entertainment on podcasts. So if you feel like rambling, I won't stop you. Don't worry. It's all good. So
okay,
with me,
Mark,
today.
Flag me down when you need to, Mark.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I am very.
Word, Scott. Scott, we need a safe word.
Safe word. Okay.
I'm very.
Scott, shut up.
Excited to have with me today, Scott Murphy and Mark Crow, also known as the two guys from Andromeda. They made the Space Quest series. It's a big honor for me. I'm just going to spill it a little bit right here that's Space Quest 2 was actually one of the first adventure games I ever played, and kind of got me into the genre. And the fact that it's sci-fi and also a comedy, that helped a lot, because those are, of course, two things I'm pretty into as well.
Thanks very much, Jonah.
Not a problem.
Quite a compliment. We appreciate that greatly.
So as a person who has continued on into, you know, doing my own creative projects, I have to say Space Quest was a big influence. So, I had to get the gushing out of the way first. So.
Now comes the Walter Cronkite.
Oh, yeah.
The Dan Rather.
So, for those that don't know, you guys have been doing this for quite a while. Started in the 80s for, well, maybe you guys can give me the history. I mean, you were there. I mean, I was just a kid.
Scott's got more of a memory for dates than I do, but yeah, it was like mid 80s when we started on Space Quest.
Yeah, we actually shipped Space Quest 1 in, I believe it was October. It was either, I think it was late September of 1986. Mark, I think, was there, actually started with the company in 82, if I'm not mistaken, Mark, the summer of 82, and then I started in March of 83. And so we were both in totally different, you know, Mark came in to get a job in the graphics department or something like that, Mark. You'd
right.
have to speak to that. And I came in, I was just there. I was cooking at a restaurant down the road, which was kind of an interesting thing because the then Sierra executives, you know, the very fledgling, Sierra, or online systems, as it was called then, used to come down to the restaurant I worked at, and they'd all get kind of blitzed a little bit during their lunch meetings, and then one night when Ken came home, he found his house burned down after he and Roberta had come home with their young children, and they ended up having to come to the restaurant I worked at, and I ended up having to cook their dinner for them, and then within a year, I had talked somebody at Sierra in to let me work there, and it took a long time before I got a chance to do, before we got it. Mark and I ended up meeting, through happenstance in a sense, because of the company moving. I'm rambling, but there was
okay. I was going to ask if you had to get anyone tipsy when you first got them to sign the job contract for you, but
actually I think that there was a bit of tipsiness because there was a little bit of financial tipsiness going on, and not in the good way. The company had grown like a weed, but if you're familiar with history, there was a great shakeout of the cart industry. And a lot of companies that people that were really common back then went by the wayside,
right,
and didn't survive it. And Sierra barely survived it. Only through Ken's sacrifices, literally, with putting his home on the line and things like that, that did the doors stay open and the checks keep cashing.
Wow.
When we had the big layoffs happen, we were up to about 115 people. I was managing customer support by then. I had started out as a dealer returns person, worked my way through customer service, answering game questions and then questions about our database and so on. And then I ended up just kind of like falling into this job of managing the department. And in the meantime, before everything happened, the famous Redwood building that people know about from Sierra was being built for the large company. Well, by the time that building was complete, we were down to 35 people. And my department ended up being right next to the programming department, the game programming department, and I got a chance to view those people, and I thought, wow, I want to do that. And also, I knew one person in there, and who was a very good friend of mine. And this is—I don't mean this as an insult, but I thought, if he can do this, I can do it.
So, how did you learn the programming side? Did you just have to do it kind of on your own time then, or?
Exactly.
Okay.
I had to manage customer support during the daytime, and then as soon as 5 o'clock hit, I think Mark might have, I'm not sure exactly how Mark's situation is, but I ran out, grabbed some dinner, and then headed to Ken's house, and we worked in his. He had a really nice room with a big wall mounted desking all around it and plugs, and so I went over there, and that's where I actually had to learn the AGI programming language that we were using then for the really high level kind of scripting language. And so that was I all I knew was AppleSoft at that time. I mean, I conned myself in kind of, and Ken said, "Okay, well, come on out and let's see what you've got." And so going out there, I was learning from him. I was also learning from Al Crow on programming, and it was like drinking from a fire hose is what I describe it as. And while I got a little bit of water in my mouth, I got pretty hosed down at the same time too. So, by that time, Black Cauldron was in a sort of a shape that it was really down to debugging and that sort of things. And that's where I met Mark.
Cool.
And Mark might want to take it.
Sure.
I was going to ask Mark, did you do
what I was doing while you were doing that, Scott?
Hello?
I think I was learning how to. I was being. Hello?
Oh, I can hear you guys.
Okay, great. Yeah, I was learning how to do graphics, create graphics using a graphics tablet and animation and everything, and working on King's Quest II of all projects, and learning how to do animation initially. That was my first first experience with working on a game, as opposed to doing the other stuff that I'd been doing before, which was all, Doco creation and box illustration and that sort of thing.
Did you have have any kind of background in programming for that side of things, or was that kind of
art? Absolutely not. In fact, you know what? I was pulled into the whole computer graphics end of things, kicking and screaming. Really, it's not really what I wanted to do. I enjoyed what I knew, and this was all alien to me. And it was quite an adjustment for me to begin learning how to do computer graphics because it was all very cutting edge. Not just for me, but for the entire industry. So in that way, it was kind of daunting.
Did you have a background in art, like from school, or did you just draw a lot? I mean,
yeah, no, that my background was graphic arts, graphic artist. That's what I was doing prior to coming to Sierra. I was working at a label company, designing labels and doing just real basic cut and paste up kind of work and illustration and that sort of thing.
Okay.
That's what got me a job at Sierra
because they
needed a commercial artist there.
And he made a really cool logo for our favorite pizza place.
Yeah. Well, that's what brought me to Sierra was, well, I shouldn't say that's not what brought me. I came up there because I read this newspaper article that there was this computer company, which I didn't understand the whole computer thing at all. It's totally alien to me. There was this company in Oakhurst that made computer games, quote unquote. I thought, well, that's intriguing. And so I went up there and took my portfolio with me and met with the art director there and showed him my stuff. And they offered me a job on the spot. And I said, when can you start? And that was kind of amazing. And what was funny was that was just kind of on a whim. My real reason for going up to Oakhurst was, that was where I was from, basically. But there was a small pizza place called Danny's Pizza, and I knew the guy was branching out and was going to be franchising his operation. And just totally on spec, I created this logo for him and everything. And that's what brought me up to Oakhurst, is I wanted to present him with this logo and say, hey, what do you think? And, of course, he wrote me a check. And it was kind of funny. He said, as he was writing me a check, is you're going to really regret that you sold this to me for this much money. And he went on to great things. But that was the day that I interviewed at Sierra, and they offered me a job.
And we went to it was a place called Danny's Pizza, or it ended up being the Pizza Factory, and we ended up going there so many times. We ate so much Danny's Pizza over the years, and
you may have bumped into Pizza Factory, Jonah. They have a couple of places up north, but they have one on Bainbridge Island that's been real successful for them.
I will have to check that out if there's a local one to me.
there's one on Bainbridge Island.
I don't know if it's still.
Are we talking the Sierra? Seattle area.
Pardon?
Are we talking the Seattle area?
Yeah, in the Seattle area. That's where Danny Wheeler ended up moving.
Oh, okay. Because I used to live over in Bremerton.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I would have known that. I'd have been over there. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you guys, since you're a team, you know, a duo, a lot of the classic games, you know, there's usually like the one person that people associate it with. But everyone, you know, that the two guys from Andromeda personas really solidified, you know, the team aspect of it. So I was curious how that collaborative process got started and how it works as far as, you know, doing writing and art and programming, like the kind of the back and forth of, you know, going, you know, off to the side, doing your thing and bringing it back as a team and discussing it.
Sure. Well, I don't know. I can tell you that I jokingly have said before that, you know, between Scott and I think we together, we kind of complete a normal functioning brain, but two sides. I mean, Scott was definitely more of a programming type person, and in addition to his wacky sense of humor and his love for sci-fi and everything, and between that and my artistic skills and imagination and everything, I think it's just all those things that together we formed a well-rounded set of design skills.
Yeah, we found that out, those things about each other in the wee hours of the morning, as Mark actually described it. He just put together this really cool PDF as well as a PowerPoint thing that really kind of tells the story of it. And we were working, and we were both kind of like, you know, by come 2:33 in the morning, and we're just like, you know, kind of goopy as hell. And by that time, everybody had gone to bed, and we were still working away trying to finish up our respective tasks for that day. And we found out that we had these similar ideas, and that not to say anything really bad about King's Quest or anything like that, but we thought, well, you know what? There's got to be a market for. We weren't thinking so much about a market as much as games that we thought would be more fun to somebody like us. And Mark and I laughed a lot, and we spent a lot of time, you know, joking about things. And then we found out we both had interest in space and sci-fi. And when he says that I had a strong interest in sci-fi, a very big influence to me was 2001: A Space Odyssey. When I was a really little kid, I went to Hollywood and got to see it. Downtown Hollywood when it was still on the big screen there. And I'm not like a hardcore guy. I did read a lot of like Martian Chronicles and stuff by Ray Bradbury and so on, but I can't say that I'm like a really traditional sci-fi geek. But I was a junkie for the space program. I was a kid that got up, you know, at 3 a.m. to watch watch Apollo 11 or to watch Apollo 9, whichever, going around them, just circling the moon, and I watched the Geminis and all that stuff. I just any chance I got, I watched whatever broadcast that Walter Cronkite was hosting or whoever. And so it was just
likewise. I was really big into following the space program and what was going on with that.
I always wanted to be an astronaut. Went to this career opportunity thing in seventh grade. Found out, there's no way. You got to have, 12,000 hours of flying experience and this and that and the other thing. And that was before, of course, the shuttle program. So, and they dealt with mission specialists. But so my astronaut dream was taken away from me, and I was very sad.
So ultimately, we just ended up inventing our own space program.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's a little more fun. Something.
Yeah, we did. We just thought that everybody didn't want to ride around in forests and carry shields and take care of princesses. We thought, well, what if the protagonist is not the most noble person? He's just kind of getting through, saving his butt, or when things got rough or whatever, and. And so
every man kind of guy. And I think we were projecting to a certain degree. I mean, it was easy for us to put ourselves into that mindset and that role.
Definitely. Yeah. Well said, Mark.
Yeah. I always enjoy the protagonist who doesn't have all the answers. That's, that's definitely one of the appeals, to Space Quest, and a lot of adventure games are good about that. You kind of feel like the fish out of water. That's probably one of the things I'm drawn to in them. So as far as, like writing scenarios and stuff, who is that, done as a team, or is, one of you kind of take the reins when it comes to the writing aspects?
It's kind of a back and forth process. I'm sorry, Mark.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's kind of a back and forth thing. Mark and I have what we lovingly call the wall, and we, because of the office that we were in, the office that we actually sat in after Black Cauldron finally shipped, and we just were working some regular hours, and we didn't really have anything assigned to us to do, and so we just kind of got itchy, and Mark had these new skills that he developed on the art tools, and I had these new skills I developed with the programming language. And the talks we'd had those late nights finally kind of settled into our consciousness, and we realized, hey, well, here's an opportunity, maybe we should try something, just take a shot. And so we put together what was the first four rooms of Space Quest, and like I was saying, that it was really a tough time financially, and I think when we talked Ken into it, when we pulled him into the office, it was sort of like, I've got nothing to lose kind of a situation for him. But Mark and I it's been really an interesting process. We never did proper design documents, even though the company really wanted us to. Mark and I did so much seat of the pants work, and we would talk about, okay, well, here's a cool thing, and then here's a cool thing. We would like start and an end point.
Well, I think we were basically writing the book on game design as we went along with this thing, because I wouldn't know what a game design doc looked like back then. I mean, I think we were inventing it as we went along. And the other thing was, too, is just the time crunch. I mean, we were always under this tremendous time crunch to get the next game out. And so we were just pulling stuff out of our butts left and right. Just to, again, like Scott said, throwing stuff on the wall, seeing what worked. And the beauty of it is, it was just Scott and I. And we were so close to the technology. And Scott was able to just make stuff work. I would make art and throw it at him. He would throw it in there and make it work. And that's kind of how the game evolved. It's like, as Scott says, seat of the pants, game development. That's really what it was. It worked for us. I know in this day and age, that probably wouldn't fly, but depending on the situation and where the development dollars were coming from.
Yeah,
but
how does it work? I mean, nowadays, is there a bigger team behind you two working on this new game, or is it pretty much the two of you again?
Well, that's just it. The beauty of it is we're getting back to basics. It's just Scott and I for now. We're trying to keep it as small as we can. We don't want this thing to explode.
Right.
Become this big, unwieldy team situation. And because that's what happened to us on Space Quest 4. We started to see, as we went into VGA graphics, we had to bring more people on the team, and it became very difficult to manage. And that's kind of the nature of video games nowadays, because it takes so many people, such huge teams, to get the games out in such in a timely fashion, so that companies can meet their ROI or whatever.
The metrics are so important on everybody's time expenditure, and justifying people's existence and so on. And
a friend of mine put it, I think, pretty well. He said the era that you guys were originally making games in, he considers kind of the punk rock era of game development.
That's a good way to put it. I like that.
Sure.
Because it was a lot of small teams, putting out something that was just straight from them, and that nowadays, unfortunately, doesn't happen as often as you'd like.
Well, if you think about the most innovative stuff that's come out in the last umpteen years or whatever, this the really groundbreaking stuff, that's how that stuff worked. That's how that stuff came about. Mm-hmm. It was a group of really super creative and passionate guys that got together, you know, really small groups that just did it and made it happen, and then you know, everybody else, of course, globs on to that and
right.
tries to replicate their success.
I was going to ask about the two of you being having such a background in game development, if you either of you are really into gaming as a hobby, or if you, since it's your job, you kind of steer clear of it outside of that.
It's been kind of an interesting thing. I know that Mark has been more involved in things as far as being, you know, he's been in the industry. I felt a really a big sense of burnout because there was kind of an interesting thing. One thing I wanted to say earlier about when you asked about the design, how we did stuff was that Mark and I were truly partners on everything. There was not one person that did more than the other. Although Mark came up with some very innovative ideas, and there were times when the games were art driven, and there were times when the games were text driven. Kind of, you know, it's like we would come up with ideas, and one of us would spit something out, and the other one would go, "And what if we did this with that?" Or you know, that sort of thing. We had this really interesting communication where it's kind of not unlike twins, I think, in a sense. You find that you don't needed a lot of words to communicate with each other, and Mark and I were blessed with that. It's something that, unfortunately, because we'd never been through this in the situation before, we didn't realize how fortunate we truly were with that. And
definitely in hindsight, looking back, we had it pretty good, and we've come to recognize that for sure.
Yeah, we never had a bad time. We never had an argument any time during any of the games in any of the game development. The only things we suffered from were burnout and because of, like Mark said, the schedule and but we never. By the time we got done with the game, looking at other games just did not seem too appealing. And although I had a break in Space Quest IV when our team was basically hijacked for King's Quest V, there was a lot riding on King's Quest V, the company projections and so on, the quarterlies and all that. And because of the new SCI 32 had come out, which was the newer, bigger, badder version of it, was like the third iteration really of our game. Engine, and it was object oriented, which is another thing I had to wrap my head around. And anyway, while those guys were doing that, I was the only one that wasn't pulled to work on that stuff. They said, "You sit down and make design documents," and so I sat back in my corner and I played Monkey Islands 1 and 2. I really loved that. Those games made me laugh so hard, and just the unique approach, gaming became, when it becomes your profession, I mean, there, you know, you do have your passion, and some people, you know, do study their passion when they're not actually working at it. And I think it was a little bit tougher for us. We had families that we had to get back to, and
sure.
We had time to make up for, and some wounds to heal as far as, you know, the time away from family. So I think in my case, it was, it was a little more prohibitive as far as looking at games more.
It was the same. It's been the same for me all through my career in the console game market over the last 12 years. I mean, you're always kind of in game evaluation mode. You never really have time to actually enjoy a full game unless you're crazy and you want to stay up 24/7 playing games. And I have a wife that wouldn't allow that. So I'm always in game evaluation mode. I mean, you fire up a game long enough to play it and get it, and it's like, okay, I get how this works. Time to move on. And it's always, you're looking at a game for a reason, because you're working on something else and you're doing research. And so that does tend to take some of the fun out of playing games out of it. But I mean, every once in a while you lock into a game and you lose sense of time and realize, oh yeah, I got to get back to work.
Or get some sleep, or one of the above.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I have a young daughter who is a year and a half, so.
Oh,
okay.
Fortunately, I am very lucky that my wife also games, so she actually understands that, you know.
Boy, you are very lucky.
I am.
Yeah, my ex-wife was not that way. We were married for 20 years, and And it, she just didn't appreciate it until the royalty checks started coming in.
That helps. <though.
laughs> Yeah, it does help. It helped. It helped her do something else while I was unavailable. And anyway, enough of that.
I wanted to spell right now is that you know, Scott and I did get royalties on the Space Quest stuff, but neither of us. I don't know if it's obvious or not, but neither of us became filthy rich from those games. I mean, we made a decent living, and we were able to, you know, support our families and everything, and that was great. But, you know, none of us are like fat cats sitting back counting our money because of the riches that we inquired during the Space Quest days.
So with that being said, now you have the Kickstarter going, which I'd like to talk about because that was kind of the point, was to bring more attention to that. As much as I can help bring attention to that is what I'm here for. So,
great, we appreciate that.
Oh man, that is awesome.
It was a pretty exciting announcement in the first place to see that you guys were back and working on a new project. And we even joked on the podcast, the general gaming one that I do, with my brother, that, you know, I said, hey, it's not even a Kickstarter. That's kind of weird. Everyone's doing one of those. And not a week later, you guys announced the Kickstarter. So I said, oh, sweet. Now I get to send them some money. what prompted that? I mean, was that just you saw other, people have been out there lately? I mean, it's pretty well known about the Double Fine situation with Tim Schafer, and I also contributed to that, so I've been enjoying following that project as well. Was that kind of what spurred that on, or was that kind of already in the works before that?
One thing that went on a long time, and Mark and I actually lost track for a while of each other, and I think I was more socially active, and so I received a lot of emails, I'm not saying I got one every day or, you know, but I got something every week from somebody somewhere in the world, and over the years that ended up adding up to a lot. Sometimes I would get a couple in a day, or you know maybe 5 or 10 in a week, but and then once I got on Twitter, it really blew up. But we had so many people that we didn't realize. You know, the ones, kids that had been like 13 or 14 and, you know, 12, whatever, had been playing the games as youths, and then now are, you know, honest to goodness citizens and you know, tax paying individuals, you know, from the United States, different countries, and they're playing the games again with their kids and telling us how, you know, I mean, I actually hate saying this sometimes because it just sounds kind of, I'm not always comfortable with it, but they said that playing these games changed our lives. And, you know, for instance, for some people for whom English isn't their first language, it helped them learn English and how to type and understand pop culture references and American slang and so on. And then other people who tried to get into game development or just became IP, you know, I mean, you know, information, you know, IT people, professionals and so on. And, and it's like, well, you know, that's a lot of responsibility. We were just being silly, and I hope we haven't messed up your lives. You know, I was thinking in the back of my mind, and then we still had these fan sites out there all these years later, and then when Mark and I finally got back in touch with each other, it was just a matter of the timing was just really incredible. It would just happen to be the right time, and we realized that we still had our passion. We just, you know, things had changed a lot. Mark had gone into family mode, and I was kind of like in family dissolving mode, because of various things in our lives, and it really kind of, it really took, you know, it separated us for a while, there's a famous interview out there that I made, and it was based a lot on misunderstanding, and not really knowing what was going on with Mark and Sandy, and not understanding their point of view on how life was, and them looking for, you know, to be able to, as a very young family, get out and start their own, you know, get out on their own and to raise their children the way they wanted to, where they wanted to, it was just kind of a strange thing. But once Mark reached out to me, we talked, what I don't know, Mark, what was it, like 15 minutes or so, and we pr- pretty much cleared up all the, you know, the misunderstanding, and we'd apologize to each other for the stupid things. I had more to apologize than Mark did, I think, and because of some of my some of that sleeve content that we talked about, and
there was definitely a clearing of the air, and it was all healthy.
And but, we realized how fortunate we'd been.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mark. I'm sorry,
but I was just going to say, you know, it's to use some cliches. I mean, it really was just this perfect aligning of the planets, perfect storm, whatever analogy you want to use. I mean, the Kickstarter thing was certainly a catalyst, but I mean, over the years, there have been a couple of times where Scott and I had talked to each other and kind of just briefly and kind of poked at the idea of trying to resurrect Space Quest, because it was obvious there was this huge fan base out there that wanted it, but because someone else held the license or whatever, we just said,
right,
well, that's just not going to happen, you know, and that and being busy with their own lives, things, life just kicked in and took over, and those were just kind of withering ideas. But yeah, it was the Kickstarter thing that was the major catalyst, obviously. I mean, it proved that sorry, not the Kickstarter, but the Double Fine Kickstarter specifically, because they didn't even have a game idea. It's like, hey,
yeah.
There's obviously there's an interest in adventure games, and this whole fan funding model was just fascinating. It's like people who made these games can make the games just for the guys that want these games, and so it was just it was a beautiful thing. And it's like, okay, that was kind of the catalyst for getting a hold of Scott and saying, hey, Scott, have you seen this? You know, we should talk. And we did. We got on the phone together and talked about it. And that was kind of like the spark of this whole thing, trying to get something going.
And Mark reaching out and, you know, having the guts to do so, given how I'd been so outspoken and so harshly, it was really a relief to me that he had the guts to do it. And it meant the world to me. And, you know, I had to eat a lot of, stuff. But talking about that stuff on my sleeve, it was nice to have that weight off of my arm. And,
yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, yeah, that interview, even though it was like, I don't know how many years ago you did that, Scott.
Yeah, it's been four or five now.
I probably found out about it like a couple of years after you had actually wrote it, is when I actually stumbled upon it. And I read that and I thought, you know, it just kind of clicked. You know, Scott made some really good points. I wasn't verbally appreciative of his contribution to the games as much as I probably should have been, just because I was so focused on my aspect and my end of things. But I realized, okay, I can understand his feelings and why he would have hurt feelings about that. And so it was really healthy for us to get together and kind of clear the air and put that, really put it behind us. And we both said things that needed to be said and got it behind us, and it's all water under the bridge now and ancient history. So,
well, that's awesome.
that's
so cool.
It's pretty important to us that if we can get that story out. I mean, really is, because Mark and I, the thing that we didn't realize, like I tried to explain, and I hope I'm, you know, you said tangents are cool, and I hope I'm not overdoing.
Oh yeah, go for it.
But yeah, I mean, Mark and I really, I mean, seriously, our working relationship was great, and I don't know of any, you know, you hear about people who have, you know, partnerships through the years and how they, you know, it seems like everyone has some kind of a breakdown at some point. Ours was never because of creative differences or anything like that. It was totally
personal differences. It was just
it was personal life. Yeah, it was the pressures and personal life changes, and I was totally ignorant of what Mark and Sandy were going through with new children. I had a wife and I had a couple of stepchildren, and they were getting older and they were spending my money at massive rates, and
they're good at that.
I just wasn't seeing what Mark and Sandy were going through with new children. I mean, and the funny thing is, when we went up and we shot our video at the airport and some of the other things, that Mark's youngest child, who's now 21 and who is just an incredible videographer and so on. I mean, that little kid that I remember seeing spit things up was the guy that did such great work and directed us and looked at us with, you know, kind of lifted an eye at us once in a while, you know, and like, what am I
awesome.
Got myself into kind of thing. No, Justin is a great kid, man.
That video was cracking me up, by the way.
Justin did such a great job, and he put up with us, and he's like, what am I doing with these two old men?
You know, we both have had to step way back and look at this thing and say, you know, this isn't about us, and it's not about the crap we had to deal with, Sierra. This is about I mean, look at the fans that love the people that we influence that love these games, and you know the fact they're playing these games now. That was another part. This is another part of that perfect storm thing. Is those people that love those games that grew up, and a lot of them became people in the game industry because they were so inspired by that. And that is the ultimate compliment. But the fact that they're now playing these games with their kids, and there's this just this resurgence in interest in adventure games. I mean, obviously. We'd be crazy not to get on our surfboards and ride this wave.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to doing that when my daughter's a little older. I tried to go back and play one, thinking, oh, I have this memorized. Yeah, it's been quite a while, so I'm kind of starting from scratch trying to play through that one again.
Hey, we're having the same issues too. we've been talking through the games on podcasts, and it's like, I don't know, Mark. Did you come up with this? Did I come up with this? You know. Do you remember this being in the game?
it's hard not to want to look up a walkthrough. The internet makes it a little too easy sometimes. We used to solve these games by the playground rules. We would go and find other kids that were playing them or had finished them, and you'd have to describe in detail the scene you were on and what items you had in your inventory and see if they could help you out. That was how we got through a lot of sequences when we were playing them.
Yeah,
you know, the old saying, what goes around comes around, I guess maybe that's the one I'm thinking of. But I mean, it's this whole thing's cyclical, and I knew it was just a matter of time or years that before, you know, the genre of adventure games came back in vogue, and we've started to see that in recent years in the console games that have started taking on more of an adventure kind of format. And so it's just, I knew it was just a matter of time before the types of games that we created would come back in vogue.
Yeah, it's nice to not always have to be shooting people in the face.
Exactly.
It's nice to have a break from that.
That was the death of adventure games. I mean, I remember when was it Duke Nukem, when that started circulating around the office and everybody was playing it, and it's like, okay, if this is the end of what we're doing.
Ooh.
We're making adventure games. This is the death now.
Writing was on the wall, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And so now it's, you know, it became, and then through evolution or whatever, or through that whole cyclical process, people got tired of that and they needed more, they wanted more story, they wanted more character interaction and everything in their console games. And so, yeah, I think we've come full circle.
Yeah, one of the interesting things also was that there was a purity about Sierra when it was a smaller company, and as Ken grew the company, I'm sure he did it for all the right reasons. One of the things that unfortunately happened is that he ended up becoming insulated to some degree, and where he and Roberta were really innovators, and it was like let's lead the industry, let's make people let's set the bar. There was a point, for instance, when Myst came out, as an example, where all of a sudden this term started going around the office: Myst killer. We need a Myst killer. and literally, it was like, that's when Sierra quit leading and started following.
Uh-huh.
And first person shooters and so on. All of a sudden, if it wasn't already proven on the marketplace by somebody else, they weren't willing to take a chance with things. And that was kind of a sad thing, but it was just really a sad time for us.
It's really funny to hear that killer term applied to Myst, because I did some PC gaming, but was mostly a console gamer. I mostly was hearing it over the years and applied to Halo. Every new shooter was the Halo killer. So it's pretty amusing to me to hear it applied to Myst. You need the Myst killer. I played a few.
I remember when Myst came out, we were like, oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. I was in junior high, I think, when that came out, and I was pretty blown away.
It was beautiful.
To use a generic gaming journalist term.
It was beautiful, but it was sort of like, I always take it back to the Prisoner to some degree. I was a big fan of The Prisoner. There was when Sierra used to actually dupe games for Peachtree Software, and The Prisoner was one of their games. It was, you know, it was just line drawings and stuff like that. I can't remember his name. I hate it. But the guy that actually wrote, David Milich, I think his name was. I actually did finally get in contact with him eventually, and I played that game before I actually got a job at Sierra, because somebody was nice enough to loan me a computer, I was actually able to play it, and it had some of the cleverest stuff in there. For instance, if you knew AppleSoft, every once in a while it would tell you there, it would pop up and it would say, it's the whole thing about Prisoner, the old series. I don't know if you ever got to see it, but it had this thing where the whole thing was, he was on this island, they were trying to get his retirement code out of him. You know, why did you retire? And so the game was all about getting this number from him. And the game would all of a sudden pop out, you know, on the Apple, it would say, error at line 420 or something like that. And so you'd say, you know, if you knew anything about AppleSoft, you'd say, list 420. And then all of a sudden this thing would pop up and it would be just all these sheep butts popping up on the screen one by one by one. Welcome to the flock. And they had beaten me. And it was like, oh man, that is so cool. You know? I was mad, but I was so thrilled at the same time. And you know, it was just that, it was that kind of really cool innovation and stuff that, I mean, there were things like that that really had a big effect on me. And it was like, you know what? I mean, they played cool mind games on us. And we thought, well, you know, and I think that was one of the things I carried into Space Quest as a writer.
Yeah. When you were talking about the fans earlier, I know you'd mentioned the fan sites. Are you guys aware of all the fan games and even the attempted sequel to Six that was in the works for a while there?
Yeah. I'm sorry, Mark. I keep jumping in.
No, hey, go for it, man.
I had too much coffee.
It's good. It's all good.
We're very much
I'll
aware
riff
of
off
them.
You.
Okay, well, that's cool. We're very aware of them, definitely, and a lot of people have made me aware of them, especially over the last several years, it's a really strange thing, and I've tried to as delicately as possible explain to people that we're so grateful and we feel so honored that you guys are still carrying the banner for Space Quest and that you put so much work into it. For instance, Infamous Adventures put out a Space Quest 2 and they had to get clearance from Activision and make sure that they didn't make a profit on it. That was the only way
right.
they were able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, how many people would dedicate, you know, I don't know, a year and a half or 2 years, I think they put into it.
It's insanity.
Yeah, exactly. And, it was one of those things where it's sort of like if somebody takes your baby away, you don't want to watch on the news or whatever or see over the internet what they did to it. And so, you know, Mark and I had this vision, you know, it was just this feeling about it, a real ownership. And even though we didn't, because of the way that we created it on Sierra Time, it ended up being Sierra property.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something where we said, okay, we're going to contract with you and we have this game, but we retain rights to it. It didn't work out that way. Mark and I were not sophisticated enough to understand it. And honestly, if we had to go in front of a jury or if we just had to stand in front of Ken or whoever and say, you know, what was, yeah, we thought about it on Sierra Time. You know, we thought about it on our own time too, but you know, we can't deny that we were on the payroll when the core of the game really came up, and so it's tough. And then looking, one of the things that I always worry about, I have a problem with, is that I fear unconscious plagiarism, and I don't want to look at people's other stuff necessarily. Mm-hmm. Along with the problem with our baby and somebody.
Yeah, I share that same concern.
I worry about looking at things that other people do, and then just the way that my memory is, you know, I might grab something, and, oh, that's a good line, and then I'd hate to find out later, like I have in, I've just had a couple of lines where I found things where I've written where I didn't realize that I thought, oh, that was pretty clever of me. I mean, not really, but I was something I was proud of, and I realized, oh man, I was really heavily inspired by this, or maybe I just blatantly ripped this. It turns out I blatantly ripped this line off, and so I've avoided them and tried to explain to the fans that we appreciate it, and I'm not sure that it was always accepted the way that I meant, I think that they think I was just like maybe, you know, kind of snowing them. To use better language than I might.
That's why I was curious, because it's a very tricky line to walk. When, I mean, there's the whole, you know, if it were a comic book, people do fan art, that's one thing, but this is an interactive experience. I mean, that I can't even imagine the amount of work that would go into making these other games, and especially matching the art style and everything that they take so much time and care to do.
Yeah, I did a Google Plus hangout with a couple of our super fans and some other people that they'd invited. Many of them were in Denmark, and we had several across the United States. And we actually watched the sun come up over one of our fans' shoulders. They stayed up all night for it, but they really made a point to let me know what games that they thought were really the best and that truly reflected the qualities that they appreciated in Space Quest. And so I've agreed reluctantly to some degree that after we get done with Space Venture, that I will indeed take a look at the games that they made, since we're currently not having to, currently not able to do anything with Space Quest because of IP holdings by somebody else.
And I'm sure that gets asked a lot. Like, what's the future of that? Are you guys trying to get the IP, or is that even an option?
Sure.
Or is that just completely up in the air at the moment?
Well, I mean, we've gone on record as saying that we actually have approached Activision and tried to, to inquire about getting a license. And, we were kind of politely turned away. We spoke to a high-ranking gentleman there. We were turned on to the right people, talking to the right people. They obviously have plans for Space Quest. They see the value in it, especially after the whole Kickstarter thing. And, But yeah, they turned us down. But that said, I would say never say never. I mean, this might be something we revisit in the future. At this point in time, we've moved ahead with our plans to do something original.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, revealed the protagonist, Ace Hardway.
Yeah, definitely so. And his dog Rooter.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Scott and I have really moved forward with the notion that we're going to do this game hook or crook, and we're just brainstorming ideas for what the game's going to be about.
Mm-hmm.
And we see, the importance of letting people know, the people that want to fund this thing, giving them a clear idea, clearer idea of what it is we're envisioning and what we want to make.
And he seems to have a little more competency in some ways than Roger. I mean, he's more of a handyman than just a janitor.
Yeah. He's not somebody who sleeps in a broom closet. He's somebody who takes his job seriously and he goes at it.
Yeah, he's proud of what he does, and he has a very active imagination as far as what he could be or what he'd like to be as far as he's sort of a Walter Mitty-esque a character in a way.
Right.
And but he takes his job very seriously, but not overly seriously.
Probably too seriously, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. We're bouncing that back and forth. But, yeah. He definitely has that. But we have some really cool ideas in our heads as far as how it's going to play out. And so far we've had some. Having just announced it today, so far the reviews we're getting back from fans are pretty positive. And so we're hoping that we're on the right track.
I like that he doesn't look like a hero from any other game. Like, it's you can't mistake him for someone
exactly.
else, which I can appreciate.
Yeah, we didn't want him to be this hunk character earlier.
Yeah.
We definitely wanted him to be the underdog kind of character that we're associated with.
This is one of the things that I've been so blessed with when working with Mark is just amazing art ability, how we can talk about something and how he can turn it into something that is beyond what I imagined even. And, but the thing is that Mark really took the lead on this, and this came from this character. We talked about his characteristics, but Mark really made this guy come to life and really gave him his character and his character properties and so on. And this is largely Mark's work. And I take a minimum of credit for anything that he did on this one.
Well, I mean, we talked about the character, what his traits were, and what we always ask ourselves. The first thing is, well, if we were to make a movie, who would we pick to play this character? I mean, who personifies this character in real life? And that's what influences us when we develop a character.
So, who influenced him?
No, gosh, I knew you were going to ask.
you led me right into it.
That one. Man, I stepped into that steamy pile.
You don't have to say if it's a big secret right now.
Actually, it's an amalgam of characters, guys that we like, that we think personify the personality that we're trying to give this guy. And, like Kevin James and the characters he's portrayed on TV, Patrick Walburton and the Kronk type he's cool and macho, but he's kind of clueless maybe. But it's just kind of all these characters rolled into one.
Okay. So you also mentioned in that newest update, I think it's still the newest update, the non-linear approach that you're taking with the new game, which is pretty interesting to me because of how story-driven adventure games are, how that's going to work. Are they going to be like smaller stories that all come together, or one overarching story, but you can solve different pieces of it as you go, or is that still being worked out?
Well, it's obviously still being worked out. I mean, we've learned a lot over the years, and what a lot of games do now, you know, they provide alternate paths to, mm-hmm. to get to a certain solution, and we certainly want to provide the player with, you know, alternate means. There's not just one solution to solving a puzzle. That definitely makes our job harder.
Yeah, but, I can imagine.
But I think it makes the game more enjoyable. I mean, sure, there's going to be those linear moments where we're trying to propel the story along, mm-hmm. but we want to give the player the sense that they have some choices, and to arrive at opportunity to arrive at a better solution, and they can go back and play replayability is key in our minds, and we want players to be able to go back and replay the game and figure out different solutions that might give them different outcomes.
Yeah, like Mark said, there are, you know, ultimately it's a story with a beginning and an ending, and mm-hmm. it's really tough to to some degree there is some linear nature to this, but one thing that we learned from Space Quest 3, for instance, was that people loved having the opportunity to go where they wanted to go, like for instance which planet. They liked the freedom of being able to get into a ship and to go to different places and solve different things as they wished. And so what we want to do is offer them that freedom also, so that it's not just following an exact storyline as far as, we may look at it in chapters, but it may be in like a few chapters rather than several chapters. You know, where they're able to go someplace and deal with this situation or see these characters or deal with this interesting race of what would be to them aliens. And so we want to have the most fun we can have with them. We want players to not feel trapped and then feel there was that thing, and I'm sure you must have had it when you played the games before, where you got stuck in one place and there was nothing else you could do.
Right.
And when Mark and I were making sure
to buy a hint book.
Exactly. Or call that expensive, unbelievably expensive hint line.
Oh, I never got to do that. I would have been in a lot of trouble.
I'm glad you didn't get in trouble, but yeah, it was just very cruel. I mean, the internet will obviously, you know, once the first person blazes through the game, and there are always going to be people like that, it'll be out there, and the temptation to hit it will be really tough, I'm sure, for some players. And
when I've reviewed adventure games a few times, I have to say, not having anyone else playing it to help you, that makes them pretty difficult sometimes. That's why I know some modern ones have even put in a hint system within the game because of that. You know, they figure they want to help you solve it without having to close the game and go out to an FAQ or something. Not to derail what you were saying, but it just made me think of that.
I just wanted to throw in that, this is our grand vision for the kind of game we want to make. But obviously, you know, we have to scale, adjust our dreams accordingly based on how much financing we have. I mean, the bottom worst case scenario is that we end up having to scale back our vision and just basically create a vanilla adventure game that takes you from point A to point B. From A to Z, I guess, and but obviously we want to be able to provide the player with more depth and some alternative solutions to puzzles and some alternate paths to get from point A to point Z, and of course all of that means more time, more money, and that's ultimately what we get back to.
So is that worst case scenario if the Kickstarter doesn't fund, as you'll just scale back?
We'll just scale the thing back, and we'll provide a real basic A to Z adventure game.
Okay. So I see you guys have posted a few times about the voice talent that's been lined up. Who's been announced so far is already very impressive. So can you tell us a little bit about how that came about? getting in touch with those different voice actors?
Those were those are clients of Chris Pope. Chris is a Space Quest junkie. Chris came down in July. He wanted to do a, he actually produces several podcasts, like for Rob Paulson and I forget the other people that he actually who are actually under his podcast banner. Chris represents these people social media wise. He helps them set up their fan bases on the internet and so on. So Chris already has great relationships with these people. He'll be going down to Comic-Con and stuff like that to be able to hang out with some of his clients. And to me, Rob Paulson, for instance, is just an incredibly kind guy. For some reason I forget what the name of his podcast is, but when you hear him and you hear guys like Billy West from Futurama, and guys that have done, you know, Ninja Turtles and just so many other titles, and people who have also voiced games. These people love what they do, and Rob's just like this really great guy. He charges money, for instance, on his website for autographs, but mm-hmm. $5 of what he charges is just handling, and all the rest goes to I think it's Wounded Warriors and campaign Something Smile that helps where these doctors go and help and work with kids in different countries that have cleft palates to help their lives have more quality to them and so he donates stuff but you listen to these guys on their podcast and they just love what they do. They love working with each other. They were really excited when they found out that we had Gary Owens working with us and that he'd had a pass, because they all admire him. And Gary is somebody that we were, when I wrote lines for Space Quest 1 and 2, for instance, and stuff that Mark wrote also, in my mind it was always Gary Owens' voice that I used when I wrote stuff. I said, okay, how would this sound like coming out of Gary's voice, you know, out of Gary's head, you know? So when I read a book, I have to hear a voice in my head. I can't just look at text and buzz through it. I can't speed read. It's just not possible for me. I have to hear somebody narrating, basically, or at least speaking their lines. We've been just so fortunate to have these really talented people that Chris is in contact with. When you get to know somebody like Rob Paulson, and you realize just what truly kind and excited and enthusiastic humans they are for what they do, and how grateful they are for the careers they've had, and that the fact that they have hooked up with Chris and want him to represent them on, you know, at a certain level. They obviously have agents as well, but you know, it's just like, well, okay, you know, this is how good can it get? You know, we're very fortunate.
Yeah, I mean, as a fan, we, you know, me and some friends that are following the Kickstarter have discussed how, like, it's just one more thing to just be kind of shocked by, wow, how cool is that, you know, that they've already got this voice cast going for a game that we're already excited about. And I know Gary Owens' voice work, I was kind of the same way after playing 4, you know, then going back and playing the old games, that's anytime it's not dialogue between characters, that's definitely the voice you hear from then on in Space Quest.
Oh, that's good to hear. One of the cool things too is that, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I'm a Craig Ferguson fan, the Late Late Show,
mm-hmm.
and he's got Jeff the Skeleton, you know, Jeff Peterson, the Skeleton Robot, and there's a guy named Josh R. Thompson who does the voicing for him. Guy does a killer Morgan Freeman. He does Matthew McConaughey better than Matthew McConaughey does. I got a Twitter from him last night saying, I have to be in this game. Because it turns out I had Twittered something to him. It was just like a smart-ass comment about something that he posted. And he goes, wait, are you Scott Murphy from Space Quest? You got my pimply ass through high school, or pimply face through high school. And
blew me away.
Yeah, I know. Because I watch that show all the time. And I think that Craig and Josh are like the best sidekicks on TV and talk shows. We have this budget that we're, you know, we have to worry about and so on. And we already have these other people, you know, this great voice talent. But I would so love to be able to get Rob in there too. I mean, Josh in there too. And
you know, we were in such awe when we managed to. I still don't know how we managed it to get Gary Owens of all people. Most people probably go, Gary Owens who? But to Scott and I, you know, our age group, Gary Owens was a living legend. it was just amazing to us, and that we were just in awe that we were in this guy's presence when we were doing recording sessions with him. Well, the fact that we even got him in our game was just we were just totally geeked out, and we're right back there today. I mean, we got Gary Owens, and we have these other legends in the animation voiceover business. We're thinking about just even considering being in our game. We're just so flattered, and it's just amazing to us.
Yeah, definitely. It was such a score. And Gary is, I mean, really, I wish you could, I could be in one of the sessions that Mark and I did with him. He's just such a, there's just no exaggeration. He's just one of the kindest human beings. For instance, when I was down there recording Space Quest 6 with him in Hollywood, it was the night of the Oscars. It was the year that Pulp Fiction was up for an award, and I think they won the best screenplay or something like that. But Gary had to host an Oscar party at the Palladium, and we had done 2 days, and we still had a little bit more to go. And he says, "Well, I've got to go and do this thing at the Palladium, but if you want, I'll come right back over here. We'll get in the studio, and we'll knock out the rest of these lines if you guys really need to get this done." And I was like, "No, Gary, really, it's cool. Go ahead and have a good night." And that's neat. But thank you.
No, Gary, sorry, man. The Oscars thing is off, man.
Yeah. Forget the Palladium, dude. You got work to do here. No, and he was so nice. And then after we got done, he goes, "Hey, how about if I record some answering machine messages for you?" And he got the guy to plop in a cassette into the board, and he just improv some answering machine messages for me and my wife, and it was just so cool, and it was so funny. It made me feel so good to have written something where he would read through it, and in the middle of it, he would bust up. And it was like, oh man, you know, I would get goosebumps, you know. It was like, it was just so cool. You know, at first, the first hour was like tough. It was like, how dare I tell Gary Owens how to stay a line, you know? but then sometimes, you know, with some of the odd terminology that we would use, mm-hmm. you know, I had to explain certain things to him. I was like, okay, well, what this thing is, Gary, is this this or is that? And you're getting pulverized by a chicken, or, you know, one of the grizzly deaths or whatever. I'd have to explain it to him. He goes, oh, okay. And then he'd just like snap that thing off, man. He would just nail it, and I think that he enjoyed the fact that it was different, because when I was working with him, he was doing ABC voiceovers, I believe, for next week, you know, if I were, you know, he was right. Doing a lot of stuff like that, and still doing a lot of commercials and so on, so it was just such a cool thing. I just really can't describe it. It was like just a dream come true.
I swear, there's takes in Space Quest 4 where you can hear him laughing as he's saying.
Oh yeah, he would bust up. I remember him just cracking up trying to get through the lines. Yeah, that was quite flattering, actually.
Yeah, you're right. You're not the only person that's mentioned that.
Yeah, Scott and I actually worked with Gary on two completely separate occasions and not together. I mean, I did the first recording session with him for Space Quest 4, and then Scott did it for Space Quest 6. And it was the same experience for both of us. I think we were just kind of in awe of working with this living legend in the entertainment industry. And wow, yeah, the guy could just rattle off these lines and that Scott wrote. And Scott. Scott can write some pretty interesting dialogue, and the fact that Gary was able, of course, Scott wrote it with Gary in mind, as he said. So, I think he was just like dead bang on, and the fact that Gary was able to just rifle through this stuff, it was just pretty amazing to watch. There was no directing involved. It was just like watching this guy go at it.
Yeah, it was just like a matter of, okay, well, something, we didn't get a good pickup on that certain word or something like that. You know, there was, you know, other than explaining just bizarre terms that I made up or whatever, you know, that was the hardest thing. It was like, oh, how do I pronounce this? You know, he would have a question, you know, it wasn't a matter of him, you know, in any way him being, you know, falling short on what he was doing. It was just a matter of him trying to understand the material. Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, I was amazed. Some of the things I thought I was going to have to explain to him, I did not. He had 3,000 some odd lines to do, and he blazed through them.
Yeah, this had to be completely alien to Gary Owens when we did the first one, because, you know, up to that point in time, he just did these, you know, one of these sound bites and everything. But I think this was the first time he had any exposure to interactive entertainment, and the whole idea of having to cover all these different variables and everything with different sound bites. I think he was, I'm sure he was taken aback by the amount, just the sheer amount of dialogue that had to be recorded for this stuff. But he just tackled it like a real professional, and it was amazing to watch him work.
I'm sorry we've gone on this really long tangent on the
That's
voices.
That's okay. I'm very interested to hear.
Scott and I have totally geeked out about Gary Dolan's work.
Totally.
Being a fan and all, it's totally fun. The friend that I did the other podcast about Space Quest with will love that segment because he's a big fan as well of Gary Owens. So,
Our guy Glanz Henderson, who does our updates on our website, he's a news guy out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and he got into radio because of Gary Owens, as it turned out. And he and Chris just happened to grow up together and played Space Quest as kids.
Wow. So before we go, because I actually have to go pick up my kid, but that's okay. No, I got a little bit of time left because I want to ask about the fan involvement with the new project and how that's been going and how that's different from the way it used to be, where it was just the two of you, doing it all on your own. I mean, has that been enjoyable or kind of surprising that people feel so strongly?
It's been interesting. I mean, yeah. we approached this thing from the beginning that we wanted to get our fan input, but I think we've made it clear and abundantly clear that ultimately this is Scott and my project, and we're going to do the kind of game we want to make. But we definitely want to get people's input. And we take that into consideration, but we are going to follow our own gut, so to speak, with the type of game we want to make. And I think we made that clear with our character selection and that sort of thing. But we definitely want to hear from people and hear their ideas and thoughts and reactions to stuff. But at the end of the day, it's going to be the game that we want to make.
Yeah, we've told people that we if they want to send in ideas, that they're welcome to do so, and send it to contact at guysfromandromeda.com, and in the subject line put unsolicited game ideas, and that we may blatantly rip them off. We may blatantly rip them off, so don't be surprised. But anything that they send to us, it becomes the property of guysfromandromeda.lc.
Right.
And but awesome. Yeah, we definitely listen to the fans. I mean, if it weren't for them, we wouldn't be. We wouldn't be having this opportunity.
Well, I hope you guys knew going in that people on the internet have very strong opinions, especially gamers. So
yeah, we found out in both directions how that works out.
Yeah,
and so yeah, right. it's been.
I think Scott and I have learned that following our gut has gotten us this far and has worked out pretty well for us. So we're going ultimately that's what we're gonna do.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
We definitely appreciate everybody's input, and everyone has an opinion, and we're certainly open to hearing everybody out. But at the end of the day, we're going to make the decisions and go with our gut.
Yeah, especially that extra few cubic inches we've gained through the years.
Yeah. We have a lot more gut to go on, that's for sure.
Yeah, we feel like we're richer in that regard. Actually, we're quite svelte, and we feel like we've still got our boy-like physiques. But
in our dreams, yeah.
In our dreams, exactly.
Well, all right, guys. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today.
I'm sorry if we derailed any questions you had.
No, that's totally fine. I addressed it adequately. I had some other people that were supposed to be sending me more questions, and they didn't follow through, so it was just me and you guys. So,
if we can do anything to fill things out or whatever, if you'd like, we'd be glad to help out any way we can.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you know how to get a hold of us. So,
all right, awesome.
Feel free to reach out, and we'll be glad to. It's been fun doing this with you. It's especially we've done some other interviews, and some of them have been a little dry, while some of them have been very fun. But you've been one of the fun ones, and we appreciate
that. Oh, well, thank you.
I hope that doesn't come off as stroking. It's just
you gave us a long leash, Jonas. That's dangerous, Jonas. Well, that's dangerous.
I mean,
if we get the chance next time, you'll know better.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd love to follow up with you guys after the Kickstarter either way and talk to you again. As of this recording, you're at $336,400 out of $500,000. So the goal
is
hours,
within 6 days, 17 hours.
People have work to do.
You do. All right. So don't forget to go to
Chuck that cat.
The Kickstarter page. Now, you guys have a short URL.
TGAKick.com, I believe it is.
Okay. I was trying to find that as we were talking, but I failed to do so. And you can also follow their Twitter accounts. The one promoting the project is twitter.com/AndromedaGuys, and your personal ones are /Vohal for Scott and Wilco Fever for Mark. And I don't know how much you guys actually use your Twitter accounts. But
I'm on mine all the time. In fact, it's on right now. I've been watching.
Scott lives
on
Twitter.
We have a tornado warning right now. I just found out. Thanks.
Yeah, I use it a lot because I have a lot of friends that are out of state. One of our friends that is now teaching in Japan, so we we communicate through that a lot.
Friends are out of state. I'm in Alabama taking care of my mom.
Yeah. So thank you guys again. We'll definitely want to talk to you again soon here.
Awesome, Jonah. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely, Jonah. You've been
pleasure.
It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
Well, that's it. Thank you very much for listening. If you would like to see the Kickstarter for yourself and help fund the project, just go to tgakick.com and that will forward you to the Kickstarter page. The Kickstarter ends next week, so don't delay.